and then transferred on the 10th or 25th to the OPEX account from which I paid the initial bill. By the way, with all these advanced accounts, the nickname you give each is entirely up to you. I call this one my reimbursement account. Because you don't want this money hitting your income account, set this account up as a checking account and deposit the reimbursement or pass-through money right into it. Materials account. If most of your revenue, as indicated in the instant assessment, falls into top-line revenue and does not flow through to real revenue, then most of your income is pass-through revenue, and the core of your business is basically the management of that pass-through. If this is the case, set up a materials account for the money that is allocated specifically for purchase of materials. Do not allocate it for anything else, ever. If for some reason there is money left over at the end of the quarter, in other words, you had a larger profit margin than expected, move that balance to your income account and make the allocations accordingly. The materials account functions in the same way the pass-through account does, but it is broken out separately so that you know its exclusive purpose is for materials. Subcontractor commission accounts. If your business does not purchase materials but uses subcontractors or people paid on commission instead, set up a contractors or commissions to allocate the funds to pay these fine folks. Treat it just like the materials account, but apply it to contractors and commission-based team members. In the case where you both purchase materials and use contractors, use both the materials and contractors account. Employee payroll account. Employee payroll is relatively predictable. Full-timers are on a salary, and part-timers, for the most part, work an average number of hours per week. This means you can look at the cumulative gross pay for your employees plus the payroll taxes you'll incur and allocate funds from the operating expenses account to the employee payroll account every 10th and 25th. If you use a payroll service, set them up to pay the payroll from this account, not your operating expenses account. Equipment account. Similar to your stocking account, this account is for big purchases you may need to make further down the road, such as new computers or a high-end 3D printer. Estimate how much you might have to spend on future equipment purchases, divide it by the number of months you have to save up for it, divide that number by 2, and allocate that amount every 10th and 25th to accumulate enough money for that big purchase. DRIP account. This account is for retainers, advance payments, and prepayments on work your company will complete over a long period of time and for which you have yet to expend resources. Say you get a big project, congratulations by the way, and you receive $120,000 from the client upfront for work you will complete every month over the period of a year. That means that each month you will really be earning $10,000. So when you get that check, put the $120,000 into the DRIP account and then automatically transfer $10,000 to the income account every month, or better yet, $5,000 every 10th and 25th. You don't touch any of the balance in the DRIP account. You only make allocations when you DRIP a portion of the funds, in this case, the $10,000 each month, into the income account. The DRIP account will help you manage the true cash flow of earned money so that you can manage your expenses and costs. For example, the labor doing the work will be paid monthly. I helped implement a DRIP account with my friends at TravelQuest International in Prescott, Arizona. They provide their clientele with once-in-a-lifetime trips, from viewing solar eclipses from the best vantage points in the world, to visiting the South Pole to see the Aurora Australis, to experiencing zero gravity in outer space. People book these trips up to 5 years in advance, while the majority of the company's expenses occur during the year of the event. Enter the DRIP account. Petty cash account. Set up a bank account and get a debit card for petty cash purchases, such as clients' lunches. Then allocate a regular dollar amount from your operating expenses account to petty cash. Me? I allocate $100 every 2 weeks for myself and also for a few employees who need it. The funds cover gifts, lunches, and other small purchases. Sorry, if I'm buying, we likely aren't having an 8-course meal. If it's not in my petty cash account, it ain't in my budget. Prepayment account. As I shared in Chapter 6, you can save a considerable amount of money by prepaying for services. Car insurance costs less when you pay for 6 months rather than monthly, And some services will give you deeper discounts if you pay for an entire year in advance. Set up an account specifically to set aside funds for prepayments so you can take advantage of those deals when they're available. If the discount is not offered to you and you have enough money to cover several months or a year's worth of services, offer to pay it up front for a discount. Most businesses will be happy to comply. Sales tax account. If your business collects sales tax, every single stinking penny of that sales tax you collect is immediately allocated to this account. For example, if you sell something for $100 and the sales tax is 5%, you will deposit $105 into your income account. First, transfer that $5 into your sales tax account, then do your profit first allocations with the remaining $100. Sales tax isn't even legally your money. You are just acting as a collection agent for the government. So never, ever treat the money as income. Just bang people over the head for their sales tax and turn it over to the king. That's the government. Figure 6, which again, I know you can't see, I'll talk about in a second, is my own account setup. The account numbers are made up, of course, and the balances are not my real numbers, but they do show a very typical breakout of the cash, and the names of the accounts are the real names I've assigned to my accounts. So let me just kind of explain the graphic to you. There's three columns. I have bank one is one table and bank two is the second table. Both of them, again, have these three columns. First column is name, second one's the account, and third's the balance. So name is the name of the accounts I have. The account is simply the account number, which is fictitious, and balance is the dollar amount in there that's fictitious. So of course I have the income account. I know you expect that. The foundational five are here. So income, profit, owner's comp, tax, and OPEX. And next to each one, if you've been paying attention, is my cap percentage. So profit has a 15% cap. And then in parentheses, my TAP that I'm shooting for in profit is 18%. Owner's comp's at 31. I'm shooting for a TAP of 32. And then it goes on and so forth. I also have my advanced additional, if you will, accounts here. So I have petty cash, employee pay, reimbursement, and drip. And next to the petty cash, I actually have a dollar amount, $75. So that means every 10th and 25th, I do a $75 allocation. I actually do $100, but this is a different business, and there is one I do a $75. And employee pay, there's a number of $1,500 next to it. That's the employee payroll allocation. These are fixed numbers that are going to come from the allocation of the money. And then the employee pay and petty cash will come from OPEX. So once the money is transferred into OPEX, those fixed amounts are then transferred to employee pay and petty cash. The reimbursement and drip accounts are inward bound, meaning they don't get an allocation. The reimbursement is whenever someone gives me a check to reimburse, I put it right in there. So there's a zero allocation to it. It just gets deposits. And same thing with the drip. The drip account just gets money, gets deposited into it. That's a retainer. And then it drips back out to the income account. In bank two, I have profit hold, tax hold, and I also have the vault there. So that's one of the advanced accounts. Remember, this is available for download. So you can go to mikemikalowicz.com, go to the resources section. This graphic, all graphics are there. And so when you're next time in front of a PC or a Mac, I don't know why I laughed at that. I have both. You can download it. Okay, let's get back to the book here. Next to each name, I put either the dollar amount or percentage that goes into each account at the allocation times. That's the 10th and 25th. In the parentheses, I've put the TAP I am targeting for that account. You should do the same. Looking at the numbers, I can see instantly where my business stands. I can run an instant assessment at any time. For the purposes of this example, I set my required personal income at $10,000 per month. From there, I can instantly calculate the total business income I need to make between every allocation period. Write down the process. Create a single-page document that defines the function of each account. Explain what purpose each account serves and the process you will follow. For example, document that on the 10th and 25th of the month, all the money in your income account is distributed to the profit, owner's comp, tax, and OPEX accounts based on the respective percentages. Then, the specific dollar amounts, $75 for petty cash and $1,500 for employee pay, are transferred from the OPEX account into the respective accounts. Finally, the total money in Bank 1's profit and tax accounts are transferred to Bank 2. This process is a system, so it needs to be documented. Your bookkeeper might have to take this over for you. Otherwise, you might drink too much one night and forget the rules you set up for your accounts. Heck, you could end up allocating all of your money to your Eric Estrada fan club fund, a fan club of which you are the only member. Even Eric dropped out. Shift your focus from the monthly nut. The famed monthly nut is a horrible distraction. It's up there with reruns of The Jersey Shore. The monthly nut is a remnant of the gap mentality that simply tells us the number we need every month to keep the doors open. And that is nonsense. The monthly nut is a focus on, you guessed it, expenses, not profit. The concept of the monthly nut makes you focus on expenses and do everything you can to earn your nut with enough sales. In other words, it has you put costs first and makes the goal to cover expenses, not to improve profitability. Can you say survival trap? Good. I knew you could. You get what you focus on. Stop focusing on expenses. Focus on profit, and the expenses will be taken care of by default. Screw the monthly nut. Instead, focus on your required income for allocation, the RIFA, or RIFA. This is the money you need to deposit by the 10th and again by the 25th to have a healthy business, to pay the salary you want from your business, and to take the profits you deserve, period. My business partner, Obi-Ron Kenobi, I give everyone nicknames if you haven't figured that one out yet, teaches a simple method to achieve this. Take your monthly required personal income and divide it by 2 because you are getting paid twice a month. Then divide that number by the percentage being allocated in owner's comp. Using the made-up amounts on figure 6, I would divide 5,000 by 0.31. The result is just over 16,000 in business income, which means that by the 10th and 25th of every month, I need to collect and deposit around $16,000 into the income account to cover it. It's really that simple. There are 24 allocations per year. So to annualize it, multiply the 16,000 by 24, and you will have the annual business income requirement, which in this case is $384,000. For you to take $5,000 every pay period, you need to generate $384,000 and, of course, live by the specified allocation percentages. So when I look at my income account, which I mentioned in that graphic, I know instantly that I'm currently falling short by $3,000. So I'm going to scroll back to the graphic here for a second. And if I look at my income account, I'm at $13,432. I need to be $16,000. That's why I'm falling $3,000 short, and I can tell instantly. Every 2 weeks, the income account drops to 0 when it is allocated, and I need to rebuild it to $16,000 or more. Yes, there's a nice chunk of change in my drip account. Again, going back to that graphic, it's about $20,000+. But that money is for services I will render over another 12 months. So it will only account for about $1,000 every allocation period. Using the system, my sales revenue minimum becomes very, very clear. When you have more than one business owner. Just one more point about owner's comp. If you have a partner or multiple partners who are also getting paid, you need to add up the total income requirements for the owners. So if you need $10,000 a month and your partner also needs $10,000 a month, the total owner pay is $20,000 per month. Divide that number by 2, then divide it again by 0.31, and you get a RIFA of more than $32,000. That's the required income for allocation. Why profit and tax are $0 at Bank One. You may also notice that the profit, 15%, account with Bank One is at 0. That is because it is simply a holding tray for a day or two. Money gets allocated from the income account and goes to the profit account at Bank One. Then, on the same day, I initiate a transfer to Bank Two to pull the entire amount of money out of the profit account at Bank One and put it into the profit hold account at Bank Two. That is where the profit accumulates. And I can see that it looks as though I will have a real nice $7,000+ profit celebration at the end of this quarter. It's a simple calculation. $14,812.11, that's what's in the example, times 50% equals partay. The same holding tray is in place for my tax account. Allocate and then remove the temptation immediately. Also, you may notice that no bank summary grand total is shown in the table. The accounts aren't all automatically added up to show a total combined balance. Many banks do this for your convenience, but I suggest you disable that option if you can. The grand total of all your accounts shows you all the money on one big plate again, exactly the thing we want to avoid. Looking at a grand total messes with your mind, so don't do it. Raising capital. Raising money is a risky endeavor. I generally discourage it, unless you have an extremely high confidence that an investment of money will bring in a lot more profit. How do you know if an investment will bring in more profit? You will know only if you are already profitable. Be profitable first, and when you know what exact elements of your business are making that profit, you can consider using outside money to amplify what is working. There are many more considerations than just that, but profitability is a foundational requirement. Also, I hope you talk with an accounting professional or financial expert who understands raising money before seeking the money. If you do raise money, you need to do a quick advanced technique of profit first. You guessed it, set up another account. Call it outside capital. All the money goes there, and it is used on the schedule and as specified with the use of funds you agreed to with the investor. If the dynamics of your business change and there is a better use of funds, you agree to a new plan with the investor. And if you don't need the money just yet, it sits there until the right use and time presents itself. In fact, T-Sheets, a rapidly growing time tracking software company, did exactly that. Matt Ritter, the co-founder, raised $15 million for his business. He got the funds and then smartly sat on the money until the right time and opportunity came together to use the money to amplify what was already working. Note, everything in this section also applies to getting and using loan funds. Wait until you're profitable and then use the funds for amplification. How to determine whether you can afford a new employee. There is a really simple formula for determining whether you can afford a new hire, or if your business is currently understaffed or overstaffed. For each full-time employee, your company should generate real revenue of $150,000 to $250,000, ideally more, but this is the minimum. So if you want a million-dollar company, you know that you can afford 4 to 6 employees, including yourself. Now, this is just a ballpark number. Every business is unique. But do not use your super distinctive status as an excuse to hire more people. Efficiency is always the goal, always. Not hiring your husband's cousin who is down on his luck and could really use a job. Not finding space for that brilliant kid who has a ton of great ideas you could use someday. You're a bottom line person now, remember? You're taking profit first, and that's why you're forced to be careful with your expenses. And remember, we're talking about real revenue, not top line revenue. Subtract your material and sub costs before you divide by the magic number range to get your ideal employee count. Again, this is not an exact perfect system, but it will give you a better and more realistic understanding of what it means to be over or understaffed. The reason these numbers aren't perfect is because labor costs vary tremendously. A guy cooking French fries at McDonald's will make much less than the lady who engineered the next generation smartphone. In this example, cheap labor is less costly, but also has a smaller impact on revenue. The fry guy just facilitates the sale of fries, but the engineer creates an entirely new product and revenue stream. According to Greg Crabtree, the author of Simple Numbers, Straight Talk, Big Profits, your real revenue must be 2.5 times the total labor cost if you're running a tech business. This is because the tech industry traditionally requires expensive labor, highly trained people who have a big impact on revenue. If, on the other hand, you are in a cheap labor field, such as the fast food restaurant example I used earlier, your real revenue must be 4 times your total labor cost. For example, let's say you're a manufacturer with $6 million in real revenue. If you hire cheap labor, such as assembly line personnel, you will divide $6 million by 4 to get $1.5 million. This means that your total labor cost, people on the floor and the folks in the office, should not exceed $1.5 million. And if you are a manufacturer with $6 million in real revenue, but use expensive labor, such as scientists and engineers, divide the $6 million in real revenue by 2.5 to get a total labor cost of $2.4 million. Mini power tactics. Some advanced profit-first strategies require very little time and are super effective. I am constantly tweaking and improving my system. So if you want to know about my latest discoveries and share yours, visit my blog at mikemichalowicz.com. Here are my favorite ones so far. The government's money. It is so easy to borrow from our tax account. It's really stealing, but you don't need me to tell you that. Oops, I just did. The money is just sitting there, taunting us with all those zeros we could put to good use. When we cave and pull from the tax account, we don't feel the pain right away. But when tax time comes, we can get in really big trouble. Owing more taxes than we have money to pay means that at a minimum, we'll be paying interest and possibly penalties on the amount we do owe. A smart tactic is to first move this account to a third-party bank that you don't see, and then change the name of the tax account to the government's money. Now, literally, that's what I've done with my own account. You already know about the No Temptation. I have a No Temptation account for my taxes. I move it over there, but I've nicknamed that account the government's money. Now, I suspect that, like me, you would be way more reluctant to steal money from the government than you would be to borrow money from the tax account. See how that works? Hide accounts. Following the out-of-sight, out-of-mind theory, you are less likely to justify transferring or withdrawing funds from your accounts if you can't see them. Some banks allow you to hide accounts so that you can't see them on first view when logging onto online banking. Try hiding all of your accounts except for the OPEX account. You can still do the disbursements and the entire Profit First system using this tactic. It just means now that you won't consider the other accounts when making spending decisions. Outside income accounts. Chances are that as your business matures, you will add a variety of other accounts that collect income. You may have a PayPal account to collect funds, or a wire account for international business or local transfers. The challenge with these accounts is that you might start to view them as extra, like your own additional petty cash fund. They're not extra. They are part of your revenue, and you need to make sure that you protect and allocate the funds just as you would any deposit into your main bank account. For this tactic, set up all your outside income accounts so that any income is transferred to your main income account on a daily basis. Some banks will let you set up an automatic transfer for the total balance in the outside account, which is ideal as long as you keep whatever minimum balance is required to avoid extraneous administration fees. If you can't do this automatically, simply transfer the money to your income account when you do your biweekly allocations. Just note that these transfers may take a few days, so you won't instantly have the money in the income account, and you'll have to wait until the next allocation period to move the money to all the individual accounts. Account snapshot. To keep track of your accounts, set up automatic notifications for your key accounts via email or text. Have your bank report the balances of your income account and operating expenses account to you on the 10th, when all of your money has accumulated, and the 15th, when all your money has been allocated and all the checks have been mailed, and again on the 25th, accumulated, and the 30th, allocated. Set up a daily notification of the balances in your petty cash account. Check the other accounts manually. This quick report will ensure that you are acutely aware of how cash flows in, income account, and what is available to go out of your business, OPEX account, and out of your own spending allotment, petty cash account. Bank checks. Until we see that a payment has cleared, we still think of the money as ours. And sometimes we forget we wrote the check. Hello, insufficient funds charges and a ticket straight to the ninth circle of hell. This technique changes the dynamic immediately. Rather than pay with checks you write by hand and mail, if you don't lose the envelope on the floor of your car, pay with bank checks. Also called bank pay or bank payment processing, bank checks are processed by your bank quickly. More importantly, the bank will pull the money for the checks you write immediately. This way, you know the money is gone forever as soon as you process a payment. Yes, the bank makes money on the float, and you lose any interest you may have earned in the few days it would take for your payment to be received and processed by vendors. But I say, who cares? Here's the deal. If you manage hundreds of millions or billions by processing checks and transfers manually, it's a good strategy to cling to your money for a few days because the interest earned on your operating capital in even just a few days is significant. But for most entrepreneurs, the interest earned in the float is embarrassingly negligible, usually around $5 per year, and you'll spend more than that on postage to mail your payments. So let the bank do the dirty work, why don't you? Take action. plan to advance. Choose one of the advanced tactics or strategies detailed in the chapter and add it to your to-do list for 6 months from now. It may seem silly to add a to-do item so far out, but if you don't put it on the radar, you may end up forgetting that there are advanced strategies that could help you take profit first and your company to the next level. Chapter 10, The Profit First Life. When you make enough money, you don't have to budget. In Chapter 6, I shared some of my update from Jorge, co-founder and owner of Specialized ECU Repair. Toward the end of our conversation, he dropped that little bomb on me. I have to admit, the frugal monster in me initially rejected Jorge's comment as being totally out of hand. But Jorge is my kite-surfing badass profit-first poster child. So I kept my mouth shut, and trust me, that's not easy for me to do, while he explained what he meant. My mom had a good job as a pharmaceutical executive, Jorge began. A long time ago, when I was in college, we were shopping at Bed Bath & Beyond. She was buying stuff like crazy. Since I had about $60 in my bank account at the time, I couldn't imagine buying so much stuff. I asked her, "Do you ever budget for the things you buy?" That's when she said, "When you make enough money, you don't have to budget." It might seem incorrect, but because I use Profit First, I don't have to budget that much, Jorge continued. When we go on vacation, we do whatever we want. We're not crazy. We don't stay in the Four Seasons, but we go where we want, do whatever adventure we want to do. We never think, can we afford it? I'm not a millionaire, but because I follow Profit First, I don't have to restrict myself when I travel or spend my disbursement. Ah, I get it. A budget, in this case, is a restriction. And when it comes to Profit First, we implement a lot of good restrictions to make the business profitable. But when the money comes out and it's reward time, the restrictions, within reason, come off. Like me, Jorge doesn't like to use credit cards. Because he follows Profit First, he doesn't have to. He and Jose simply watch the sales, and when they cross their minimum each month, they know all will be fine. They created a lifestyle they love, and they can fund it because they know the profit disbursement is not only coming, but their business can also continue to grow without it. Profit First helps you create the lifestyle you want, even if you're just starting the system. Lori Dutcher, CEO, accountant, and owner of Secretly Spoiled, a company that started using Profit First 3 years back, shared with me that she took her family on their first Disney vacation using her first ever quarterly profit disbursement, which was 2 years and 9 months ago. A type A numbers person, Lori had been investing everything she had in her business, most of her time, and all of her revenue. "I was living check to check," Lori told me. "I wasn't taking a salary." All of that changed as soon as Lori started plugging Profit First into her well-organized system. Within months, her personal finances stabilized. And by the time her first quarterly disbursement came around, she had enough to take her family on their first trip to Disneyland. "The trip was amazing, and we've already taken quite a few more," Lori said. "But what really surprised me was, after funneling all my money into my business thinking that it was the only way to make it grow, my business actually started to grow faster when I started paying myself and focusing on the Profit First system." I want to take a little break from the book here to share a story with you about Apollo 13. Now, if I already did share this story, this is how into it I am. I'm telling it to you again, and hopefully you fall in love with it. And if I have it later on in the book, I don't recall writing about it, but I do share it in my speeches. So if you get a double dose of it, just consider it well worth it. Here's the story. Apollo 13, it's a true mission. This was during the space race. The U.S. and Russia were in the space race, and America was sending astronauts to the moon. Apollo 13 was one of these trips, and it was a trip that was destined to failure from the get-go. It was horrible. No surprise, it was Lucky 13. And the astronauts, in the pivotal scene in the movie, which is a true depiction of the actual story, the astronauts were circumnavigating the new moon using the gravitational pull of the moon to pull them back to Earth so they could return to Earth safely. Problem was, the oxygen filters had started to fail. And the astronauts radio down to Houston saying, Houston, we have a problem. Like, this one's legit. We have a problem. And Houston radios back and said, what's the problem, astronauts? And what they shared was nothing short of devastating. The oxygen filters on the capsule were failing. Now, the oxygen filters would convert the carbon dioxide, deadly to humans, back into oxygen, what we need to live. And these oxygen filters were now failing, and they estimated they had about 10 hours of oxygen left. Problem was, the capsule needed another 48 hours to return to Earth. They were on a death mission. They were on a death march. Well, in the next scene in the movie, and the true story, the lead engineer in Houston walks into a conference room with a big cardboard box. Around the table is a mix of other engineers, four or five. And the lead engineer takes the box, just looks everyone in the eye, and then dumps the box on the table. He then recounts the story that the oxygen filters are failing on that capsule. And he tells the other engineers, we have the next 10 hours to create functioning oxygen filters out of these parts. And it was like a tube, probably duct tape, a wire. It was the ultimate MacGyver moment. And those engineers found a way to make an oxygen filter. They literally saved those astronauts by using spare parts to create an oxygen filter. Now, here's what's fascinating about the backstory. NASA spent tens of millions of dollars creating the original oxygen filters. And of course, it was justified. They used, if you're an American citizen, they used our taxpayer money to create oxygen filters, and it cost tens of millions of dollars to make it, and it was well justified. But when they were given basically no time, 10 hours, parts that are you couldn't even use to create a I don't know what you could create with it, a toy, just random parts, they were able to create an oxygen filter out of it. Spare parts, no time, they create an oxygen filter. $10 million, they create an oxygen filter. And the funny thing is, in both cases, the human psychology of Parkinson's law kicks in. It's justified. When we're given a large sum of money, maybe you don't get $10 million, but maybe it's $10,000 or maybe $1,000, whatever your customers spend with you, we find a way to justify the spend of that money to create what we need to create. And I bet you do create it. Conversely, when there's no time, no money, no resources, you find a way because you are forced to be innovative. Now, I'm not suggesting that when they created the first oxygen filter, those engineers just took spare parts and sent them up there. I'm sure there was elements of the existing oxygen filter that they had to use to make the new oxygen filter. I suspect the existing oxygen filter was designed to support the brutality of the takeoff process and sustain those extreme pressures. And maybe this rigged system wouldn't be able to do it. But I do strongly suspect they could have made a functional, more stable oxygen filter for way less money. But they weren't required to. That's the power of profit first. That's what Lori shares in her story. She's a type A numbers person. She gets the numbers. And she believed that you have to spend every penny you make. We got to break out of that mentality. If you're going to live the profit first life, you do not need to spend every penny you make. Actually, quite to the contrary. We must reserve your profits first, and then let the magic power of your innovative mind kick in, just like those folks on Apollo 13, and just like Lori shared in her story. Like so many of us used to doing anything to build our businesses, including going without pay and delaying profit indefinitely, Lori had to learn how to give herself permission to use her hard-earned money not only to pay herself, but also to enjoy herself, to provide experiences for her family that would enhance their quality of life and create a lifetime of treasured memories. The business was no longer a cash-eating monster, not even close. It said bon voyage to Lori and her family as they cruised off to Disneyland for the seventh time. No one gets tired of that place. This won't come as a shock to you. Everything you just learned about creating a profit-first business also applies to your personal life. I mean, if you think about it, running your life is like running a business. You generate income and spend money. Your income varies at times. You never know when a crisis might hit and make a huge dent in your bank account. And you have a vision for your life. just as you have a vision for your business. One that, before reading this book, you may have thought hinged on a lucky lottery ticket or some other sudden windfall. Now you know better. You know that in order to save enough money for a rainy day and the celebratory pleasures of life, you need to pull that money out before you spend a dime on other things. You know that a smaller plate will help you trim the fat from your lifestyle and zero in on what's most important to you and find fun, creative solutions to get what you want. And you know that the big vision you have for your life does not have to hinge on luck or fate. It can be earned, not with $2 for the Powerball, but with a simple change in habit practiced consistently. You know what? That's a big, big deal. You created the miracle that is your business, and now, by implementing the profit-first system, you've ensured its greatness, not just in terms of profitability, but also in terms of the positive impact your business will have on the world. And just as an aside, I received an email. I'm not going to mention his name. I am so blessed now to get emails, I think almost every single day, where someone is sharing a success after having implemented Profit First. And this gentleman, he's not from within the U.S., had a struggling business. And he said that when he started implementing Profit First, I think it was about a couple years ago, he didn't believe the system would work. Fast forward today, he decided to stick with it. His business is more profitable than ever. But why I wanted to share a story was the bottom line or the closing sentence he said. He said, "Now I can live my life's purpose and serve the world." That's exactly it. Profit First empowers you not just to have profitability and live a life that you deserve of comfort and freedom, but it also empowers you to serve the purpose that you've defined for yourself. I love getting those emails. So if you have that experience, or I should say when you have that experience, please email me. I do read every email. Sometimes it takes me a while to get back, but I read every email. The Profit First Lifestyle. The ultimate goal of the Profit First Lifestyle is financial freedom, which I define as doing what you choose to do whenever you choose to do it. That will change over time. Jorge and Jose use their Profit First distributions to fund a lot of vacations in Central America, Canada, Europe, and Australia. Today, their choices are different. Jorge still loves to go on adventures, but he's more focused on helping his wife complete her law degree and pass the bar. His business partner, Jose, focused on buying and renovating an incredibly beautiful house for his family, which, because it's HGTV awesome, has now been featured in commercials. Financial freedom means that you have reached a point where the money you have saved yields enough interest to support your lifestyle and continues to grow. The path to financial freedom is paved with simple, small habit changes that become systematized and apply to both your business and personal finances. Now, I did not write this book to teach you about your family budget or your 401k, but I do know this. If you own a business, your personal financial health is in lockstep with the financial health of your business. In fact, the analogy of your business being your child is only partially accurate. A better analogy is that your business is your conjoined twin. You know what I'm talking about. Separating yourself from it must be done with absolute surgical precision. And even if the operation is successful, you will always share a soul. So, soulmate, you need to apply everything you're doing right now and planning to do to fix your business with Profit First to your life too. First, face the music. This step should be easier now that you face the truth about your company finances. Add up all of your monthly bills, plus your annual bills, and the debt you owe. Second, if you have any debt at all, stop accruing more. Put a freeze on all purchases you cannot pay for with cash. Third, establish a personal Profit First habit. Set up an automatic withdrawal so that every time you get paid, which should now be twice a month, on the 10th and the 25th, a percentage immediately transfers into a retirement savings account. If you are carrying any amount of debt, keep the retirement percentage at 1% until the debt is paid off. Use every penny you have after necessary expenses to eradicate your debt. And when I say necessary expenses, let's get to truly necessary expenses. That Keurig that's costing you, whatever, 75 cents to get each Keurig cup, go get a pot of coffee maker and get Mr. Coffee, and you'll just be fine, and it'll only cost you about 5 cents a cup. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about necessary. Fourth, set up your small plates. Create 5 foundational accounts, multiply day-to-day accounts and big event accounts. A, income account. This is the account into which you will make deposits. From this account, allocate money to the other accounts. Don't use it for any other purpose. That one better sound familiar. B, the vault account. Initially, this is the oh shit account, the amount of savings you must have on hand to get through the month if, scratch that, when something dire happens. Now, Susie Orman recommends saving 8 months worth of living expenses, but that's not doable right off the bat for the average human being on this planet. However, you will work toward it slowly and methodically, you know, profit first style. A good starting balance for the vault, 1 month's rent or mortgage payment. If you can spare that right now, transfer it to the vault immediately. Remember, this account must be difficult to access. For example, a different bank, no online banking and no checkbook, stuff like that. Once you eradicate debt, the vault will grow and grow with the intention of having the cash you save here eventually become a source of income, you know, interest. This is where money makes you even more money. C, recurring payments account. This account is for payment of your recurring bills, including fixed, for example, your mortgage or car loan, varying, that would be like a utility bill, and short-term, like an installment plan for your kids' braces, which my son Jake went through that about 2-3 years ago. It is freaking expensive. We need to prepare for that. Determine the monthly average for your varying recurring bills plus 10%. Then total your fixed recurring bills. Add the 2 totals plus the cost of your short-term recurring bills. This is the amount you will transfer from your income account into your recurring payments account every month. If you have it, transfer that amount now. D, day-to-day account. Multiple accounts if needed. There are many day-to-day costs in keeping a family running. Groceries, clothes, school supplies, Girl Scout cookies, date night. I have date night tonight with my wife. Running shoes, Girl Scout cookies, babysitting toiletries, snow tires, Girl Scout cookies. Okay, maybe I've had enough of those Girl Scout cookies. Well, maybe just one more Samoa. I love Samoas. All right, I'll stop. Set up a day-to-day account for anyone in the house who's responsible for paying for these types of expenses and transfer the amount that each person needs every 10th and 25th from the income account based on spending requirements. For example, my wife and I both buy stuff for the house. I'm the Costco king. She handles the grocery stores. And we both gas up cars and pay for kid expenses. Get a debit card for each person so that purchases are deducted from the account immediately. E, debt destroyer account. This account receives all remaining funds and goes toward eradicating debt. Following Dave Ramsey's advice, make the minimum payment on each debt. Then, regardless of interest rates, unless they are extreme, like, you know, someone's going to break your legs if you don't pay this quickly, extreme, pay off your smallest debt first. Wipe that sucker out and then move on to the next one. Ramsey wisely says that paying off a debt, however small, creates a mental momentum that will motivate you to pay off the rest of your debt faster. Remember, we are emotional beasts, not logical ones. F. You will have big events in your life, such as buying a house, buying cars, paying for weddings, likely your kids' weddings, maybe yours, college, and yet another kid going to college. Here's the deal. There are good financial programs out there for this stuff, such as 529 plans. These are just ideas for accounts that you may benefit from and are not mandatory. If you are carrying debt, I want you to cut up your credit cards. Remember, it's much easier to go with human behavior than it is to fight it. So removing temptation is the best solution. However, I do have one exception. An entrepreneur's income can be highly unpredictable. You could have an amazing month followed by a $0 month, followed by a not bad month, followed by a why do I even bother month. If you follow profit first, your owner's comp account should address this and your income should be consistent. But in the beginning, probably won't be. And if you're a startup, you may not get any cash at first. For these reasons, I believe in keeping one credit card line to buffer you in dark months. Put the credit card in a sealed envelope labeled emergency only and give it to a trusted friend to hold on to. And I'm serious about this. You must remove temptation. Here's how you manage your emergency credit card the profit first way. Every quarter, as you make progress paying down debt, reduce your credit limit by 50% of the amount you paid down. Say you have a maxed out card with a $10,000 limit. By the end of the quarter, you've managed to pay down $3,000 of that debt. Nicely done. Now you have $7,000 in debt and a $10,000 limit. What I want you to do is call the credit card company and ask them to reduce your limit by $1,500, which is 50% of the amount you paid down in the first quarter. Now your debt is $7,000 and your credit limit is $8,500. In doing this, you put up a guardrail of sorts, a mechanism to protect yourself and keep your debt total down, should you convince yourself it's okay to max out your credit card again, while keeping a credit line buffer in place should you need the card for emergency funds during slow months. When you do this, what I'm telling you to do with credit cards, there's two things that I've seen happen. First of all, people that read Profit First, listen to it like you are, say, but my credit line, there goes my credit score. I want that perfect credit score. I'll tell you, nothing is better than eradicating debt, even a credit score. But this will only have a slight effect on your credit score because you're actually paying down debt, but you're keeping some degree of a credit line. So don't worry so much about that. Our biggest goal is to eradicate debt, and your credit score, actually, if you've maxed out your cards, ain't so pretty right now anyway, so you'll slowly improve it. But the other thing, and perhaps the more insidious thing, is when you try to call your credit card company and reduce the credit line you have. I've done, of course, with my cards, and the story goes something like this. They answer the phone, and thank you for calling ABC Credit Card Company. How may we help you? I say, I'd like to reduce my credit card line, my credit limit. And they'll say, you want to increase your credit limit? No. I'd like to reduce it. It's something they're not used to hearing, so there's a little panic that will ensue. Then they'll say, well, what can we do to increase it? Or why do you want to increase it? They're going to do everything to prevent you from decreasing your credit line because the credit card companies make money off of you the more money you spend. And they know the more credit they can give you, it's human nature, Parkinson's law, that we will spend more. So their whole motivation is to increase your credit line because it will encourage you to spend more. My whole motivation and your whole motivation is to get the finances in control once and for all. So do not let them keep it the way it is. Do not let them increase the line. And yeah, they may call the manager over and say, we have to talk with a superior to reduce your credit line. Tell them, I love your credit card company, but this is critical to me. I want this done and I want this done now. And when you say it that way, they will do it for you. Understand they're in business too. I'm not calling them big bad behemoths. They're in business too, but they know the trick. The more credit you have, the more you'll spend. And I know the trick too. So the less credit you have, the less you spend. And that's why I want you to do this. Keep following this method every quarter until your credit card balance is zero and your credit limit is $5,000, as in this example, because we started at $10,000. Put that credit card in a sealed envelope and store it in a safe place. Your wallet, it goes without saying, is not safe. Better yet, have that reliable friend hold on to it for you. This is your emergency line. And I've heard another example, which I didn't include in this book, but this is it's an effective way, I guess. I've never used it. I know people that have taken their credit card, they wrap it in a small plastic lunch bag, so it's tightly secured, like they Ziploc it or something, and then they freeze it in a large, large cube of ice. They actually put it in a tray. They then freeze it and have the credit card in the middle. And now when they need that credit card, they got to pull it out of the freezer and wait for the ice to melt before they get the credit card. Talk about, you know, delaying temptation. You got to sit and wait now. And someone said, well, I can just microwave it. Oh, sure, you can do that and destroy your credit card in the process and not use it. So perhaps that's a good process for you. I know some people doing it. I haven't tried it myself, but it does seem like it would be pretty effective. Now, I'm going to go back to the book, and I'm going to drive home this point one more time about why you defend or fight off the importance of reducing your credit card line. Now, for those of you who say, but Mike, if I drop my credit line, my debt-to-credit limit ratios will fall out of favor with lenders, and my interest rates will go up. To that, I say, who cares? The goal here is to remove financial stress from your life by eradicating debt, not to get better rates on more debt. We can worry about improving your credit score once you are debt-free. Remember Jesse Cole, owner of the Savannah Bananas? If he can wipe out a $1.3 million debt in less than 2 years, you can commit to burning through your debt. That's right, burn it. Burn it in effigy. Get a mini keg and some kale smoothies and start your own damn Burning Man. Burn the debt to the ground. Rip off the Band-Aid. The day my daughter handed over her piggy bank in an effort to help solve my self-made financial crisis, I still had all three of my luxury cars parked in the driveway. Well, let it be noted, I would never put the Viper in the driveway. It's only a garage queen. That's the last strip of arrogance I had. I was still a member of the country club I never went to and had a ton of recurring expenses that, quite frankly, and even more embarrassingly, could not name. In the weeks and months leading up to that moment, I knew I was running out of time, but I still held onto the trappings of the lifestyle I had earned, but not learned. The lifestyle I thought I deserved and did not want to give up. But my daughter's amazing act of selflessness woke me up to the reality that none of that stuff mattered. It's common for us emotional humans to give up the stuff we can no longer afford or couldn't afford in the first place by small degrees. We cling. We keep hoping that something will turn around and save the day. And so we dole out the pain in small increments, biding our time. We do this because we hate loss. More specifically, we have a far greater desire to avoid losing something than we have to acquire something. This behavioral response is called loss aversion. Loss aversion is everywhere, and it is mighty powerful. Combine it with the endowment effect, the theory that states that we place a much higher significance on something we possess than on an identical thing that we don't possess, and you are dealing with a stubbornness resembling that of a three-year-old in a tug-of-war for a beloved blankie. Mine! Mine, mine, mine! For example, the beautiful red Porsche you've been eyeing, it would be nice to have, for sure. But once you have it, it's way past nice. Now it's badass, and so are you. You polish the car, you take friends for rides in it, you take selfies with that red beauty in the background of each photo, just by chance, of course. You love it because now that you own it, your relationship to it has changed, even though it's the same car you once idly admired from the showroom floor. Then you get the notice you missed yet another payment. If you miss one more, they will repossess your baby. Your baby. So what do? Return the car? No, you cancel your daughter's ballet class. She kind of sucked anyway. And your gym membership, because you kind of sucked anyway. And that trip to the Cape, because everyone knows that anyone who goes to the Cape sucks a lot. You eat ramen noodles every night. Shoot, you even cancel the insurance on the damn car and keep it parked safely in your garage until better days come along. So what if you can't drive it? At least you didn't lose it. And at least it's still yours. I behaved the same way. I cut back everything I could, but nowhere I should. Then, when I couldn't pay a bill and the credit cards were maxed, I cut just enough things to get by. The next month, it happened all over again. Only worse. Juggling bills and drumming up money were a source of constant stress. The night after my piggy bank moment, I remembered what I used to do in the past. When money was tightest in the early days of starting up a new business, I wouldn't cut expenses in ineffective dribs and drabs. I would cut them all. It was time for me to return to what worked. It was time to rip off the Band-Aid. I cut everything. The luxury cars, gone. I replaced the three cars with two basic used models. One of them, I remember, was a rusty, beat-up Dodge Durango that my wife drove around, and mine was a BMW, which sounds so glorious until you realize it too was 7 or 8 years old, and the engine literally blew up and caught on fire when I was driving to work or driving home from work one day. The swanky club membership? Gone. The little extravagances like the Netflix account? Gone. And here's what made it easier. I realized that no one gives a crap. I mean, truly, no one cares. I'm guessing you had no idea I was slashing and burning when I was in the throes. Never thought for one second, hey, I wonder how good old Mikey is making out with his financials. And I'll bet you aren't crying about me right now either. And that's cool because that's reality. You didn't know who I was. And now we're just hopefully connected and having impact, but we're not connected like soulmates. So when I'm going through hell, you don't notice, you don't care. And I hate to say it, when you're going through hell, others don't notice and they don't care. But that's also empowering. When you realize that 99.99% of the people who know you or know of you won't care what you own or where you hang out or what your circumstances are, and that the 0.01% who, for whatever reason, can't stand you will simply point the finger at you, laugh evilly, and then direct their self-loathing misery at someone else, it's easier to ditch the pimped-out ride. And when you realize that 99.99% of the people who do know you and truly love you will rally around your courage, as my family did for me, that is when you will stand up, brush yourself off, and say, let's do this. Death to debt. Now, your business will be sending you a quarterly profit disbursement check. Yippee! That is celebration time. And do you know the best way to celebrate when you have Mongo personal debt? Have a death to debt party. Super fun. It goes like this. As soon as you get your disbursement check, turn on some tunage that gets you fired up. My choice would be Metallica's Seek and Destroy, or sometimes it's Eminem's Lose Yourself. But if you don't have a mullet, do your thing. For God's sake, though, don't crank up the Barry Manilow or Escape the Pina Colada song by Rupert Holmes. We want to destroy debt here, not make love to it. Then, make sure you have a glass of libation.